all of us have some kind of classification in life, good or bad, and the classification of our speaker today is an interesting one, governmental official and management educator. And I think there is an interesting trend suggested in that second phrase. I never had any very serious problems in making presentations of projects at one of the New York foundations, except when I made a presentation on public administration. And in spite of the distinction of people like Frederick Mosier, who never applied, the answer always was, why administration? You can't teach people to be good administrators. And that was in the air for a while, but now I've noticed that, for instance, the International Political Science Association has started a new journal on governance, and it has a lot of interesting topics that include securing competence and character in public service, slouching toward anarchy, the policy-making implementation gap revisited, and some other esoteric subjects. But there seems to be a revival and a return of interest and concern. And surely no one, with the possible exception of one or two of his friends at this table, is better qualified than Ralph Bledsoe to talk about these questions. He was born in Waco, Texas. He received his undergraduate degree at Texas A&M. He received an MBA at UCLA and his PhD, doctorate of public administration at the University of Southern California. Eventually, he became the director of the School and Program of Public Administration at the University of Southern California. He was professor of management at the Federal Executive Institute in Charlottesville from 1973 to 1980, director of the Emergency Management Institute in Emmitsburg, Maryland, and then had two periods in different capacities. Two periods in the, as I identify them at least from the record, he can correct this, in the Reagan White House. He was associate director of the Office of Planning and Evaluation in the White House from 1981 to 82. From 1982 to 1988, he was special assistant to the president. And in that capacity was Executive Secretary of the Cabinet Council on Management and Administration in the Office of Policy Development in that sphere, and also a member from 85 to 88 of the Domestic Policy Council. He served at another time as consultant to for executive development to the New York Police Department and also the Port Authority in New York and New Jersey. He's been a consultant to the Virginia Department of Taxation. He served as member of the Board of Editors of the magazine The Bureaucrat and was editor of Zero-Based Budgeting in the Federal Government. And I could go on. But these are indices of his competence and his authority in this important field that periodically we seem to downgrade at least in American political science, but then continue to keep coming back to it as an essential area of what makes government work. So we're terribly pleased that Ralph would be with us today, and he has suggested that he follow our list of questions that we've used with previous people, but that after each of these questions, he open the discussion to your questions, to the comments he makes on these oral history questions.
Great pleasure. Okay, thank you very much, Ken. It really is an honor and a privilege to be with you today, and I look forward to this. I always enjoy, of course, coming back to Charlottesville, having lived here for 7 years when I was at the Federal Executive Institute, but my ties here don't seem to cease. I've also had three daughters graduate from the University of Virginia, two of whom were in school at the same time, and I find now I have two back here in graduate school, both in education, I might add, and they're one will be finishing her master's degree in special reading this summer, and another in counseling this next December. So when I come back to Charlottesville, it seems I always have family here that I can visit. But I also like to see old friends that I've had a chance to interact with before. I thought I would, as Ken says, walk through the questions as you gave me, but digress and move back and forth, because as you can understand from my biography there, that I've not quite made up my mind which side of the fence I want to be on in a number of respects. When I look back on my 30 plus years of working life so far, I find that I've been about 13, 14 years in the private sector, about 15 years in government, a couple of years in the academic world, now back to the academic world. In the time I spent in government, I was half political appointee and half career person, so I've sort of moved back and forth, and I'll probably do that as I walk through the Reagan presidency today and maybe give you some of my perspectives, a little more from an academic point of view at times, a little more from a practitioner, manager point of view at times, maybe a few observations politically, to try to give you some feeling for one person's perspective from inside the White House for about 8 years of this period that we've just gone through. And I think it's a kind of an interesting time to reflect on the Reagan presidency, because it won't go away for a while. Interestingly enough, some of you may have seen President Reagan on television last night at the baseball game, which reminded me of Len Nofziger, who was one of his political advisors, who once said when we proposed all sorts of athletic events the president might appear at when he was first in office for photo opportunities and the like, but Nofziger always cautioned against that. He said a politician should never go to an athletic event because they will never do well and they will always be booed. The spectators are more interested in the players and the people on the field, and they're there to cheer and express their opinions one way or the other, and that's a sure sign you're going to get usually a negative reaction to the politician. He's always playing second fiddle to players. So I can see last night, some of you may have noticed, the president didn't perhaps hit one out of the park, as they used to say sometimes, and so that is perhaps more backing now for that little adage about politicians staying away from athletic events. My association with Ronald Reagan goes back really to California, when I worked in the aerospace industry. And then I went to Sacramento to start up a program for the University of Southern California in public administration education. Because unlike Charlottesville, in Sacramento, a very large city, about over 700,000 or 800,000 in the metropolitan area there back then in the early 70s, you had close to 80,000 or 90,000 state government employees. And then, of course, you had another 80,000 or 90,000 federal government employees in that area. And there was one small program in graduate education and public administration for all of those government people. People who had gotten there through other disciplines, but still they were government employees, and they were wanting to go back to school to keep their own development and learning moving. And there was the small program at Sacramento State University that could only handle about 25 or so people at the master's level and had no doctoral level work at all, and essentially no extension work either in that community. So the University of Southern California was asked to come up and consider establishing some sort of program for government practitioners who might like to go back and pursue academic pursuits. So I went up, and it was at a time when Ronald Reagan was governor. And it was, of course, a stormy period in California that he had been involved with too. We had our campus problems over at Berkeley and elsewhere, and as governor he had to take strong stands on things having to do with the university community. But in addition, he was also bringing about to California another change in many ways from his predecessor, Governor Brown, who had been in office for 8 years or so. And so Ronald Reagan, who clearly thought quite differently than Pat Brown did, was there to bring about some change in that government. Not unlike what, of course, happened in Washington, where he was coming in following the Democratic president and felt he had some strong ideas about changes he wanted to make, and was undertaking that in an environment in which there was a legislature that was hostile to him. In Sacramento, of course, the assembly and the Senate there were headed by Democrats, and so he was faced with having to have very strong views, strong opinions, strong approaches to the way he went about trying to initiate his programs. And so Sacramento and California were really his learning ground. I remember when he first ran for office in California, he ran almost on the basis that he was not a politician, and he was running against politicians and politics to a great extent, which appealed to the people in California. Of course, people in California were coming from all other parts of the country, and they were uprooting themselves from wherever they had been, and so they were reestablishing there in California with new hopes and views and ideas, I guess the way the West has sort of always been. But they were coming in because of the aerospace business. That's indeed the reason I went to California in the late 50s. But he appealed to a lot of people with the idea of trying to run a growing state like that in a way that maybe more appealed to the people than to the political structure that that perhaps had existed. So he his days even in Hollywood as head of the union there were also part of his learning and training, I think, where he may have really seen what the strategy of confrontation will bring you, but also how you have to behave when you are a confronting type president. And I think that influenced the way he behaved in his dealings with Congress, which I'll comment on a little bit later. I had a chance to, since university people in a political community are fair game for boards and various kind of appointments. I was asked to serve on one of the board of directors of a foundation there while I was at the University of Southern California, and I got a chance to meet some of the people around Governor Reagan at that time, which was the reason I really got back into the White House, or got into the White House when they came to Washington. It was the renewing of this association that I had started then. But I only stayed in Sacramento a couple of years. I left there in 73 to come to Charlottesville to join the staff at the Federal Executive Institute. But in that time, saw also another one of Ronald Reagan's interests over the years, tax limitation, START. It was a very ill-fated resolution he came up with, but it came to fruition later in Proposition 13 there in California. But he had a tax limitation initiative that he and some of his staff people were working on, where he felt that the government overall was taking too much money out of people's pockets, and he was concerned that we try to limit. He, by his calculations, had it up to about 50 to 55 cents out of every dollar was going to some level of government, federal, state, or local, or whatever. And he wanted to make sure that didn't happen, so he didn't continue to grow. So he had a proposition that he presented to the voters through the propositions, and he couldn't get it through the legislature. So he went the proposition route, the referendum route in California, which, as you know, is if you get certain number of signatures, you can put anything on their ballot out there, and if you followed anything about California politics, it's a chore to vote in California because of the number of propositions that are on the ballots each year. Sometimes, some years, they number over 100. And that means when people go into the voting booth to vote, they stay in there 10 or 15 or 20 minutes just simply punching their views on the various initiatives if they understand them in the first place. In fact, one semester in one of my public administration classes, I assigned each of my students to a block of these initiatives, and their task for one of our class meetings was to explain to the other members of the class what the issue was all about, what people would be voting on. They did provide analyses for the voter, but the analysis looked like this. So it was a book you had to read to be a halfway informed voter. But President Reagan, or Governor Reagan, then put this initiative on the ballot, which would limit the amount of taxes, or limit the budget of the state government to a percentage of personal income within the state. And it would reduce each year by a quarter of a percent until it got from what he said was about 8% down to roughly 6.5 or thereabouts. But that proposition of his failed miserably, and so he did not get that through. But later, Messrs. Jarvis and Gann picked up, and as Proposition 13, that tax limitation did get put in, but it was more then on property tax than it was on personal income. But as I say, I think Sacramento's was his starting ground, and that's where you might say learned to be a leader of a fairly large entity, a large governmental entity as governor, where he had to manage a bureaucracy. And interestingly enough, his managerial style is not as it often appears to people. He's anti-bureaucrats, but his definition of what a bureaucrat is quite different than sometimes is reflected in the Washington Press. In the Washington Press, a bureaucrat is anyone who works for government or a large organization. His connotation of a bureaucrat was a person who is one who engages in the wrong kind of behavior within a bureaucratic setting. So he differentiates what he calls bureaucrats from public employees, people who are doing the government's business who are doing it reasonably well. The bureaucrat to him is one who just engages in red tape and in negativism and in blocking things and so forth, which is, of course, not always easy to identify in government, and there are different opinions clearly as to when a person who works for the government is engaging in a bureaucratic form of behavior and when he is engaging in a true public service appropriate administrative act. And that is, of course, the raging debate that has gone on within our field of public administration and will continue to go on long beyond us. But still, he while in California, undertook a lot of programs where he would reward career public employees, I might add. We had what was called a career executive assignment system in California, which would bring career executives in the government into political positions for some period of time. And they always had fallback rights to the career service, so they were not losing any of their benefits that they had gained through their seniority or whatever. And he was very supportive of those kinds of activities, and that showed through even to some extent in his federal tenure, though not always publicized. He attended, for example, every one of the award ceremonies, all his 8 years, the annual award ceremony for the presidential rank award winners. These are the federal employees who get a $20,000 bonus or a $10,000 bonus. We have two rankings of those. In fact, we increased the numbers of the people who were getting those awards in the last few years. But he was not seen and still is not seen, I think, as a, quote, bureaucrat's friend. But it's that kind of context which creates problems for some of us who worked for him, of course, in terms of when we would deal with our colleagues in the public service, and being from public administration, I feel that I was more a colleague of theirs than not. But I would have to many times justify, well, why is the president saying government is the problem? Because they take it personally in Washington, because they think he's talking about them personally. And I tried to reassure them that unless they were acting in a bureaucratic way in the negative sense, and they were not the people he was really talking about. But that didn't always fly with those groups there. But he got some experience in Sacramento dealing with the bureaucracy, shall we say, as well as dealing with the legislature there, which I think carried over and was behind a lot of the things he did as president. And I'll cover those as we get to them. But my association with him was more one of observing from sort of outside but inside Sacramento, an appointee to one of the boards, but not such that I had to. It was a foundation, a research foundation board, so I didn't have to involve myself a great deal in the politics of appointments as others did. So I was able to observe some of his style, and I found that his behavior in the White House almost mirrored that he had started in Sacramento, from the strength side as well as the weaknesses side too. And I'll talk about some of those. But the second question had to do with the initial impression of him as a leader. Did these perceptions change? As I say, they didn't change a great deal. I think probably the weaknesses were even more amplified as president, because he was more visible as president than he was as governor of California. And of course, I think his strengths also were magnified. My view is that presidents probably don't always personally deserve all the credit they get nor all the blame they get, but you do see a magnification of both of those in the job of the presidency, and that certainly is nothing new. But I think that if you look at his major leadership ability, to a great extent, it does stem from his ability to communicate. There's no doubt about that. You know, the title, the great communicator, clearly did apply to him, but it was not in just his delivery and so forth. In fact, he would be criticized for using cards. He was using cards on the television last night, trying to be a color commentator, talking about where one of the young men who was batting had come from, and he even got that sort of twisted up. I felt, for the most part, was even a better communicator when he felt strongly about what he was communicating about. While he didn't write that many of his speeches, he did influence what was in those speeches that were prepared for him. And many of the phrases and the words and the remarks that he made were clearly his, and they came from a very strong set of beliefs in certain things that he thinks should happen, and some good instincts in terms of what was on the minds of people that he was talking to. And if that's what a politician is, clearly a person who can reflect what kind of signals they see, or what kind of behaviors, or what kind of values, or whatever that they see from the mass of people that they may be with, and can reflect it back to them. In other words, be a good mirror, you might say, of what is happening. He had uncanny instincts when it came to that, of using the right phrases and the right kind of enthusiasm and gestures, even in mirroring back to people what he saw them say. So it was not so much that he was out front with his ideas that were way ahead of the crowd, as his ideas were very complementary of the crowd. And many times he could articulate those views much better than most in the crowd could, and they appreciated that. Sometimes in very simple language, not always very intellectual prose, but very direct language that the people could understand. So as a politician, he was very adept at that. And not like the politicians who get caught doing that and who are so blatant in just mouthing back what other people are saying that they're seen as something somewhat less than sincere. His sincerity would seem to be what showed through. And I think that's where his leadership may have come from, that he was able to gain followers through that technique. You know, Peter Drucker or someone, may have been Fritz Mosier, who says, you know, after studying the theories of leadership for years, we've thrown out the trait theory. In other words, the theories that there are certain traits that all leaders have, because we've found the only thing that the leaders have in common are followers, which suggests that if no one's following, then there's not much leadership taking place. Well, he was able to, find the kind of words that people would follow, and the ideas that people would follow. So he framed those in a number of places. A lot of them were his own interpretations, modern day interpretations of maybe 18th century conservatism, but still that was what a lot of people certainly wanted to hear. And I think he was seen as the one who was sort of framing this in more modern terms at the time. In fact, let me say something about him when he came to the presidency, and what context I think it's important to place around the Reagan presidency. First, if you look at where what we had gone through in the country, and this is a point I've made before, that since President Eisenhower, we had a series since 1960, for 20 years in there, a series of 3 and 4 and 5 year presidencies. And if you look at each of those presidencies, they did not end in a very positive way as far as the person is concerned in the presidency there. President Kennedy, of course, was assassinated. President Johnson stepped down, refusing to run again. He was mired in the Vietnam War, and he went out, I think, with it was somewhat of a bitter taste in his own mouth, and the public too. And Richard Nixon's resignation, of course, and then Gerald Ford, a sitting president who lost the election. Jimmy Carter then, a sitting president who lost the election, and so forth. So when Ronald Reagan came on the scene and won the presidency, up to that time, we had not had presidencies that were seen as very successful as far as the way they ended, in many ways, for the sitting president. And so I think in some ways we may have been ready in this country for some stability in the presidency itself. In other words, we were hoping, I believe, a lot of people were, that we would have a president who would last a full 8 years. And that meant they were willing to overlook some of the shortcomings, perhaps. And there were no small number of those and no small number of opportunities, I think, that the other party was given to replace the president in the first, or Ronald Reagan in that first 4 years. But I think for the most part, those who were on the fence, even though we still don't have 50% of the those who were eligible to vote voting, I think those who were sitting on the fence who did vote stayed with him because that kept some stability in our country after this period of time of ups and downs. Because even during those short-term presidencies, or less than 2 full-term presidencies, we had several changes of party in that process. And changes of party do create a little bit of chaos, not just inside the Beltway in terms of the turnover of political appointees and the like, but it creates changes in terms of the interactions between a president and the Congress, between whatever kind of reflection politicians communicate back to the country in terms of what they're seeing and so forth. And so party changes create periods of uncertainty to some extent. What's the new party going to do now that they're in power? How are they going to get rid of the old party policies and create their own new initiatives? Well, we build up so much expectation for a change of party that there's no way in the world that new party could achieve and meet those expectations. So in some ways, a new party is sort of doomed. But I think people were fed up with that, and I think we're ready for some stability in our government, and we're really willing to allow that to occur. And despite a rocky start there with the assassination attempt in March of 1981, which could have, that bullet might have been a few inches different, would have changed a lot more things for that period, but it didn't. And so a whole series of things, I think, led to to keep Ronald Reagan's luck going, as some would like to call it, but to a great extent, he made his own luck. So the perspective of his presidency, I think, is important as to where we were as a country and what we had had in the presidency. So that when you look at and when history looks at Ronald Reagan, I think in his presidency, I think they will see that it was another one of our turning points. That is where we had been going a certain direction, and then finally there was some turn toward a bit of stability for a while. I'm not ready yet to say exactly which direction we turned away from or toward. Many people will have different views on where we were coming from and where we are now going to. But whatever, it was a turning point. And that is his brand of ideology that he had expressed so much in California was now going to be that which he would, his appointees would be trying to instill within the larger body politic of the nation. So I think that turning point and moving to a period of stability will be sort of the way that it will be marked. And when I say stability, it's stability in a lot of areas. Take the economy, for example. In the first year, 1981, the focus was on what we call an economic recovery plan. That had been developed mostly by David Stockman and Ed Meese and a few others during the transition period, where they said for the first 100 days, they wrote up an initial action plan, which was about a 40 or 50 page document, but which was based mostly on economic recovery. It was not so much economic recovery, it was economic stability. The planks in that included lowering the tax rate. And as you know, he did. He wanted 30% for 3 years, over 3 years, 30% cut, got 25 of that, and then got even a further adjustment later. Second was to reduce the regulatory burden, the way it was phrased, on people. In other words, quote, get government off people's backs, et cetera. That was a relatively mechanical process of going through the thousands and thousands of pages of regulations and trying to look at those that were not needed. Incidentally, Vice President Bush at that time was put in charge of that regulatory relief effort. Reduce the growth rate of government. The last year of the Carter administration, the first year of the Reagan administration, government had grown at a rate of 17%, the federal budget had. And he said, we've got to reduce that growth rate somewhat. So now it's cut down so that government's still growing, but the growth rate is much less than it was. So that was a third plank. And his fourth plank was to stabilize monetary policy. Now, an administration doesn't have total control over monetary policy. Our friends at the Federal Reserve Board do that. But what he was doing, he realized the presidency didn't have direct control over monetary policy, but he could send a strong enough signal to say, look, I want stability. I don't want the money supply going up one day, down the next, back up, back down, and the movement back and forth. I would like for us to have some stability, he was sort of saying. As long as it was in the right direction, that was okay. That's why he was willing to accept and in fact demanded sort of incremental movements in both in federal spending. He didn't want to cut everything at once. At least he didn't. David Stockman did, but that's where the two of them sort of had differences of views. But President Reagan was willing to say, and as this politician knew well enough to say, while I want these big cuts, I know I'm not going to get them from the Congress, so we'll take mild cuts. But he wanted huge cuts in taxes, so that, of course, was going to create the huge deficit, which is the subject of a great deal of economic analysis these days. But he did say, what I would rather have is incremental change no matter what. In other words, let's not have this drastic change back and forth, just like changes of parties, which create so much uncertainty. Any changes in any other policies, drastic changes create instability too. And while some may think Ronald Reagan was trying to institute drastic changes, believe me, he was not. He was an incrementalist more than anything else, because that's what goes along with the idea of stability. And he felt the same way in his economic initiatives too. So the focus was to try to stabilize many of the kind of economic movements, you might say, and move more to increments rather than to large jumps. Kind of a fifth plank, in my view, in that economic recovery program, the one that doesn't get much publicity, but, well, which does get a lot of publicity, but it didn't get much coverage by the economists of the day, was the reduction of fraud, waste, and abuse. That is, creating the inspectors general who would root out this fraud, waste, and abuse. Now, will not allow the Reagan administration to die, as the HUD scandal keeps playing out in terms of all the people who took advantage of those programs during that period of time, legally or illegally, and many of them illegally. Some of the other kinds of scandals, you might say, that occurred during that period that we still see the procurement scandals in the Defense Department and so forth. All of those in an attempt to kind of address this business of the fraud, waste, and abuse issue. That one is still far from settled, shall we say, in terms of all of them, savings and loan issue and all the others. So by taking on fraud, waste, and abuse or saying we're going to do something about it, I think he was somewhat careful not to include that in the other four planks, but do it as a sort of a separate thing, but also not to raise too many hopes and expectations for specific accomplishments in there. He really just sort of created what he called President's Council on Integrity and Efficiency in 1981, which was comprised of all the inspectors general in all the major agencies. He then asked them to begin to try to root out waste, fraud, and abuse, and say, we'll accept what happens. Well, a lot of things were brought out that had been there long before he got there, but now, of course, a lot of things are being brought out that occurred while he was there. So we will still continue to see that one brought out. But at least that group of people, the inspectors general, I think, are a respected bunch, and I think you will see even more coming from them, even though the fellow at HUD, Inspector General there, is facing some criticism of his own. Even, I know him personally, and he is a fine public servant, been in government for a long time. But the problems that they have in terms of coming up against the political mechanism that is causing that to happen will not cease, and it will take very strong men and women in those Inspector General positions to continue that part of it. But as I said, sort of the fifth plank in this stability idea that he was trying to promote in our economic affairs. He was trying to, I think, stabilize somewhat in other ways too. He did want to cut out a couple of cabinet departments, education and energy, and found out he couldn't do that very early, so he backed off on that. But that leads me to perhaps some observations about his dealings with Congress, because is where maybe the idea of change versus stability plays out in the way a president interacts with a Congress. As I said, I think he developed his way for dealing with a hostile Congress in Sacramento. The head of the legislature at that time was a relatively young man named Bob Moretti. He was the Speaker of the Assembly, which was the more powerful of the two bodies out there, in my view. And Moretti was a brash guy. As a matter of fact, I was in a bowling league out there, and Moretti was on the team, that we bowled against frequently, so I'd see him quite often. And he was a very active guy, just with all kinds of ideas. Died at a relatively early age. Sometime after he had not won his seat again. He was from Beverly Hills, I think. But he came into Reagan's office one day and said, "Look," says, "I don't like you, and you probably don't like me." He said, "But we've got to work together in trying to run this state." So he said, "Let's make a deal right now that you and I will meet from time to time to work over the issues that we think are important to this state." And they did. And they worked it out in a personal basis. And that's where he learned a little bit of the give and take in a political environment. And it was a learning period because that was his first major, I think, job where he did find himself in an adversarial, strong adversarial political kind of situation, very unlike his union years. But I think he then in his dealing with the Congress had that experience to draw on. Now, one of the things working for him, of course, in the first term was the fact that for the first time in 27 or years or so, one of the houses of the Congress was in the hands of the Republican Party. And so he had the House, he had the Senate that he could at least rely on for some support. And I say some support because there were still, as you know, a lot of moderates and a few more progressives from the Republican wing in the Senate there that he couldn't always count on to vote with him. And he tried to take advantage of the honeymoon period to try to get as far as he could with his policies early on. The majority in the Senate helped a great deal. Of course, he went after, in the coalition arena, a lot of the boll weevils and other conservative Democrats in the House to move some of his legislation through there. And he had a very astute, quick and brilliant in many ways budget director who learned very quickly what the House's rules were. He'd been in the House, David Stockman, of course, had been in the House before, but he took a congressional process and basically said, okay, we're going to play by their game rules and beat them at their own game, and essentially did. That year it called for a first budget resolution by May 15th as to the size of the federal budget. And then the committees were supposed to stick to the guidelines that were produced by the budget committee and then produce a second budget resolution in September, then which would frame the size of the budget that would begin to be spent in October. So he took those ground rules and got everything in order, far more than any other new administration had, far more than the Congress ever expected he would. And when he went up on the Hill with the president's budget modifications to the previous budget that had been submitted by the outgoing president, he just overwhelmed the Congress. It even smacked, in some extent, of the days of Robert McNamara, when he used to go up with his PPB system and just overwhelm the Congress with his analytical talents and abilities to recall charts and numbers and figures and tables and other things which the Congress could contend with. But David Stockman was out of that mold and went forward with the president's initiatives, pushing. And that moved the president's agenda quite a long ways. And of course, that's about the time, too, later in 81, when Stockman kept wanting to push further. And the president, using his political instinct, said, it's far enough. We've gotten a lot more than I ever thought we could from the Congress, and I've bargained long enough, and I think we'll take what we can get this far. And see, that's sort of been his style all along. People used to be really stubborn. He was not really stubborn, but he was a person who would confront, and he wouldn't back off until the very last minute. And that's where his instincts came in, as to when was the time to back off. He was a politician, so he knew you had to back off. You had to compromise. You had to reach some agreements, or you'd lose it all. And so he was a person who would very much rather, for most of the kinds of things and issues he took up, he would rather win some than none. And he would back off from time to time. There are certain things he would hold out longer on than others. And but for the most part, he was the sole determiner of that, backed up by a lot of people who were giving him advice and back and forth. But he was the one who would decide when. And that's the old actor's timing. And by the way, I still feel that his actor training was invaluable to him as a president. I think it is to anybody in a position like that, by the way. Because one of the things actors learn is how to play roles. That is, to know when you're supposed to be a dogmatic, adamant leader, and when you're supposed to be a compromiser, when you're supposed to be person suspicious of someone else, when you're supposed to be warm and friendly and that sort of thing. And you learn timing and you learn how to control your own speech and your own body language and everything else as an actor. And presidents have to do that. I frequently recall one day on his schedule, when I was also planning the evaluation, we used to look at his daily schedule. We were doing a little bit of tracking at the same time we were trying to propose things to be done, but we were also tracking what he was doing in terms of how much time he was spending on national security activities, how much on domestic, how much on ceremonial, how much on whatever. We were doing a little time management analysis for him. And this one schedule one day, I recall, and I happened to be going across the street from the old EOB to the West Wing, and I saw a van pull up and a couple got out, and then a lot of their kids piled out. There were 12 or 13 kids, and they were all handicapped. And oh, your heart just went out to see those little types in their different states of handicap. And I remembered on the agenda that day was for him to see them and to talk to them about handicap programs like that. The couple had adopted all of those kids, by the way. And so that was a very emotional meeting. It was scheduled for about 30 minutes in the White House, in the Oval Office, and it went about 45 or 50 minutes, which is quite some time addition there. But I knew right after that there were a group of congressmen coming down from the Hill, and he was trying to do a little arm twisting or whatever to get them to vote on something that he was going to vote on. And then I knew he was having lunch with, lunch with the Vice President that day. But then right after lunch, we had a meeting of the Policy Council, where we were taking up a very traumatic policy issue, domestic policy. Then I knew right after that he had a meeting with the Joint Chiefs and the National Security Council people, and they were talking about some military operation somewhere or some guerrilla effort or whatever. And so I knew he had to change roles in the course of moving from one of those meetings to the other. And, you know, and heaven help us if he was still thinking about this role when he was in the other meeting. And engaged in the wrong kind of behavior. And see, that's part of actor training. You're taught, you learn how to move from role to role to role and still remember who you are, basically. And I think that's one thing about him. He still remembered who he was, even though he could play all those different roles and so on. Sure, he probably took on some of those roles, but we all do that, I'm sure, from time to time, if we think that fits our style of doing things better. And so I think that was helpful to him in terms of his being able to switch gears, you might say, when he had to move from one event to the other, much better than it was for his staff people, who couldn't make that same kind of switch. They'd be still thinking about, gee, what we should have done in that last meeting. And here they're in the middle of a meeting where they better quit thinking about that one and start focusing on this one, because it's a totally different subject. But that's the nature, I think, of the modern presidency, and which is why he may have been sort of well-suited to play that role at the time. But the policy councils and the processes around the White House.
Who'd like to ask the first question? General Disson.
I trust you believe that setting objectives and delegating are very important elements of management. To what extent did Mr. Reagan do? I'm sure he set objectives, but from what little I know of it, his subordinates were always not sure or clear about what they were. And the second one was that he delegated well, but had too many people be beyond his reach. He had delegated too many.
Yeah, I think you've mixed several things in there, which are very important to address. I think he knew what his goals were. I'll put the broader kinds of concepts there. The specific steps and actions to achieve those, he was not always as specific about. And so in that respect, it meant he did delegate a great deal to others to accomplish those goals, but maybe too much in terms of allowing the people who were to carry those out to go beyond just sort of striving toward that goal, but doing it in such a way that it achieved maybe two or three other goals, which may or may not have been consistent with that one goal. And your observation about how far away some were from him who were indeed trying to do this is a good and legitimate concern, because I'm afraid that the modern presidency will continue to have that sort of thing. But with as much as he was trying to do, and I guess if that may be the part of the cause for that, there were too many things that were trying to be accomplished all sort of simultaneously, you might say, for any kind of close control to occur. And that allowed the kind of things to get out of hand in some of the areas, and people to go way beyond in terms of the way they executed something, what was intended to be executed. And I say that in terms of the appointments that were made. And when I list his weaknesses, by the way, the first one I come up with is from a managerial standpoint, and I don't know the exact word to do, I'll use the word overlook, but it's not the precise word. Overlook the importance of personnel actions. And when I say personnel actions, I'm talking all the way from hiring to firing to discipline, et cetera. Even the quote, disciplining of David Stockman was done in a father-to-son arrangement, and that's the furthest he would ever go. He would not confront a person with a harsh rebuke, a person on his staff, even in private almost, it seems like. He would not do that to a person where the fact that they had, quote, been to the woodshed would not be played out, or it might even been seen as a sign of his strength. So as strong as many saw him, he was not strong in terms of the way he treated other people. He treated them just too nicely in some cases, people who didn't deserve always nice treatment and deserve a different kind of treatment. You know, he can discipline. You know, you can discipline in a way that's not harsh personally and so forth. And he didn't even go that far. And that's why I say overlooking is not the right term. He just had no interest in doing that sort of thing. He would rather have people around him do any of that that could be done, which didn't always get done either, because even some of the people around him who were very much like him wouldn't take that same kind of action either. They would not come down harsh on someone in a cabinet organization who may have done something that was inconsistent with his goals and so forth. But I think the delegation did get sort of diffused and in some cases almost became non-existent in terms of the kind of control that was needed. Now, the White House, I would say this, though, has a very fine line to walk, because if you over-control what some of your cabinet members are authorized to do from the White House, you pay a bit of a price there, too, for White House meddling. The Congress loves to send over a request for all the correspondence that occurred between the executive office and some agency head over a certain issue. In other words, they want to know if someone in the White House wrote a nasty memorandum to Secretary so-and-so telling him not to go up there and testify over something or whatever. You saw how much flack came out even about a very low-level OMB staff member who commented on the testimony that a scientist was going to give about the greenhouse effect here recently. So when you go into the delegation aspects, the president's relationship with those people, it becomes very important. And the mechanism you set up to have that happen becomes important. And I think we had pretty good mechanisms for the collaboration to occur between the White House and the cabinet agencies and for the delegation to generally be carried out. But the president was not personally involved in that. And so I think that delegation of authority was the area that clearly created the most problems that will be reflected in the day. And, you know, I have to say, Ollie North, that situation was exactly one of those kind of situations.
Howard.
How would you evaluate the change in his inner staff from Baker dropping out and Regan coming in.
Yeah.
Did this have a major effect on his second term?
The other way around, Regan dropping out and Baker coming in. But there was a big difference from the first to the second term. And then there was a big difference in the second term in the exchange you mentioned. In the first term, those immediately reporting to the president included three people, and then very quickly, soon thereafter, four people. So we basically had a staff organization that included four stovepipes, as I call it sometimes. That is, we had four people of equal stature that managed the staff of the White House. Two who were more concerned with what I call the president's leadership responsibilities, and two who were responsible for his policy-making responsibilities. The chief of staff, of course, was Jim Baker. Yeah. The deputy chief of staff was Mike Deaver. But see, those two had equal power. So it was not a pyramidal form. It was Baker here and Deaver there. And they divided up the leadership responsibilities, that is, support to the president, staff work to support the president's leadership, between them, so that Baker essentially had the responses to the demands for leadership, and that's the way I like to couch it. We demand leadership from a president, and different institutions demand leadership from a president. And the way the White House staff operates is what you try to do is make sure that you've got somebody that is attuned to what those demands are. So like demands coming from Congress come through the Congressional Affairs Office in the White House staff. So what Jim Baker took on were the demands made on the president for leadership from Congress, essentially from the body politic, the Republican National Committee, from public liaison, which dealt with all the interest groups throughout the country, from the governors and through our Intergovernmental Affairs Office, and basically those demands. Deaver took all of the I won't call them administrative, but the support kinds of activities regarding the president's leadership, and that is the communications, the speech writing, the scheduling, the advance, and everything having to do with how the president communicated what he was going to communicate. And Deaver also took the First Lady's office, and I'll say something about that because that's very important, under his wing. And he had some of the administrative people were there, but a lot of them were under Jim Baker, too. But see, those kind of activities around the White House staff were handled by the chief of staff and his deputy. But there were two levels, really. And the people in those offices knew which chain they reported up through. The head of Congressional Affairs reported Jim Baker up to the president. The head of communications, head of speech writing reported to Mike Deaver up to the president. Then you move over to the policy side, and you have two kinds of policies, national security policy and domestic policy, the big swamp, I call it. From the national security standpoint, in the first term, the first year, Ed Meese was established as a counselor to the president and had both the National Security Council policy apparatus and the domestic policy apparatus reporting up through him. Now, a lot of people, especially in the national security area, didn't like this. They're used to having strong national security advisors, Kissinger, Brzezinski, Scowcroft, when he was there before, reporting directly to the president. And see, here a counselor to the president was set up in between that national security advisor. And so Meese was covering both, and on the logic that, look, domestic and national security policy are intertwined. You know, our agriculture policies domestically also affect our national security relationships. And foreign policies. But then very quickly, though, as soon as Bill Clark came over, and I think that would have been either in late 81 or early 82, Bill Clark, first of all, went back with the president longer than any of those others did, had a longer return relationship. So he said, no more reporting up through Meese. I'm going to report directly to the president and reinstitute the daily national security briefings. They had not been given early on. But the so this moved four people, essentially, in control at the top. And everybody on the White House staff reported up through one of these four people. And the four of them, by the way, were then able to allocate their time to what the demands were on the president. So when the president was involved in a national security event or an issue or a meeting or whatever, for the most part, Bill Clark was responsible for that interaction. If it was a meeting with members of Congress, Jim Baker was responsible for that. If it was a drop by to some luncheon or dinner of some association, Mike Deaver handled that. If it was a domestic policy kind of issue, Ed Meese was responsible for that. So that meant they could take turns, sort of being the chief staff advisor to the president for that day event. So that really characterized our first term. And I think that was probably a more efficient way of operating. And as a kind of about a third level staff person there, as a special assistant, I found it good because I could go work with Meese and being in the domestic policy side to let him know where we stood, what the different agencies were saying about some domestic policy issue, and get a sense of his as to what directions we ought to be taking on behalf of presenting the best ideas we could to the president. And we could have some screening occurring before finally we met with the president and presented the things to him. When we moved in the second term, by the way, when Jim Baker swapped with Reagan and Mike Deaver went out to the private sector and Bill Clark went back to the ranch in California and then Ed Meese went over to the Justice Department as Attorney General, and you left Don Regan there as the sole survivor, you might say, in a strong way. We moved to the strong chief of staff model. And therefore, we went to a pyramidal model instead of the four channels. And everything now went through Regan. So that meant Regan was with the president all the time, no matter what kind of event it was. National security event, he was there. In fact, one of the most vivid portraits I can still see in my mind is the one where the president first met with Gorbachev. And the two are sitting on the sofa there. And there's Don Regan leaning on the back of the sofa. Between the two strongest leaders in the world. So we moved to a strong chief of staff model in the second term. Which meant, though, that he was with the president all the time. And you had no way to check anything out with other staff members. Because the ones he brought over with him, in my view, just did not have nearly the stature. They didn't have the experience. They just didn't have the same kind of ties or understanding of what Ronald Reagan was all about. And so you have different filtering mechanisms, shall we say.
Am I right in thinking that President Reagan was more or less hoodwinked into that?
That's what I mean earlier when I said about him not him overlooking or not involving himself enough in personnel matters. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. He was told about what they wanted to do, and he put his okay on it.
Yeah.
But he didn't have clearly the analytic work with people to advise him. Here are the pros and cons of doing that, blah, blah, blah. Don Regan had been a very good Secretary of Treasury in many respects, as far as his work with the White House staff had been concerned, at least. So as Secretary of the Treasury, he ran a good cabinet council, one on economic affairs, that kept the economic policies of the Reagan administration in the first term moving in the right direction, even when they could have gone, you know, one way or the other, but they stayed with the tax reform. You went against a lot of congressional opposition and stayed with a lot of other things of an economic nature. So Reagan was a good Secretary of the Treasury, but that didn't portend for how he would be as a number two person as a chief of staff. But it did change the whole structure when we went to a power. Then, when Baker came in, we stayed with that model. And we had a similar situation that Baker brought in some of his colleagues that he had worked with before that he could trust as the filters for the rest of the White House staff. So you had similar kind of problems, except they were nicer people to work with. And they knew a little bit more about government. They'd been in Congress on the Hill. And so just they were easier to work with. Howard Baker himself was a joy to work with. And, of course, that solved another problem that the president had. But see, even the way Reagan was let go, it just is another way that indicates that the president did not get that involved in those personnel decisions. And I consider that he could have gotten a little more, but that was his style.
Arthur Stocker.
How much of a role did the vice president play in the Reagan White House?
That's a good question, because I think Vice President Bush played a lot of roles. and did a lot of things that made him really prepared for what he's doing now. But the first task, of course, they gave him was this regulatory relief task force, which, as I said, was more a mechanical kind of an activity of looking at all the regulations. But that's very ideological, too. That's very much a conservative agenda, deregulate in a number of ways. So to some extent, whatever views Bush may have had about regulation or deregulation in the past, this almost set them in place, because once he got into that, there's no way he could come out of that not believing that we needed to deregulate. Simply putting the lists of thousands and thousands of regulations in front of him and showing him the enormity of it would overwhelm him. So I think that may have been a byproduct to kind of set his mind in that direction. But he, was called upon to. He was called upon to attend to speeches and drop bys to a lot of categories of people that didn't really go along very well with Ronald Reagan. So when there was a tough crowd that had to be met with early on, that Reagan, it was felt, should not take them on, then Bush was usually the one to go there, and usually he was a little more moderate and a little more able to kind of, soften the relationship or whatever. Then, of course, all the funerals that he attended and all the traveling he did there. And, of course, the interesting point made that one of the first acts as president was for him to go to another funeral. But then he was given several assignments around the drug abuse area. The South Florida Drug Task Force, he was asked to take that on, partly because his connections down there, too, his son and his family from Florida. But there was one activity that, a major activity that really never did surface, and partly because it was in the secure area. When the president was shot, you may remember Al Haig came running over and announcing that he was in charge there at the White House, and his exact words were probably proper, but the meaning there certainly had everyone a little concerned about the readiness of a White House to respond to a crisis like that. And remember, there was a brand new White House. Some of the people in there were brand new to Washington or hadn't been in that position for a long time. So to have your leader shot, you don't immediately think of what all the procedures are for succession and what the 25th Amendment, I guess it is, says and the like. But there was a great deal of concern about that, about the ability of us to not just react to the president being shot, but to other scandals or other leaders, foreign leaders being assassinated or earthquakes or whatever, but especially around political crises. And Bush was put in charge of an effort to build a better crisis management capability within the executive office complex. It was to respond to a wide variety of crises, but you did that so that you could go out to the agencies and get the resources you needed, primarily the Defense Department, to come over with all their communications expertise and money and so forth, to build a better crisis response management capability within the White House. What we had when we went in there was atrocious. You would not believe the lack of automation, the lack of capability for a White House to respond to anything like that. We found manual typewriters still in there. We found a few old word processing machines, but nothing linked together. The White House Communications Agency was doing the best it could, but it was really a compartmented operation just around military and national security crises, but it was not linked to the other components of a White House that must deal with any kind of crisis. And because most crises of today, that oil spill, a Chernobyl, if we have a Chernobyl in this country, that is not only a national security, that's a domestic, it's a political kind of crisis. And the White House, when we were there, did not have a very good response capability. So Bush was put in charge of building that. And he was a good manager of that project, by the way, because we would have monthly meetings. I was sort of the one on the domestic side who would represent what we were doing in terms of coordinating domestic agency responses if we were to have something like that, you know, all the domestic agencies. The national security people took care of the state and the intelligence community and the Defense Department and all those others. But Bush had that as a major responsibility, and he would manage it. He would go in, we'd give him reports, and they'd give him financial reports on how much money was being spent on it, what new capabilities we would have by X date, and, you know, a regular military project. And he oversaw that. So he got a different feel for what it means to be Commander-in-Chief, I think, because he dealt a great deal in those cases with military on a large system development. But that's one that, that he played that I think was very helpful in him getting where he is today. But he was a fairly active. He would come to most policy meetings. He wouldn't speak up a great deal. He used those as learning devices. In the economic affairs arena, for example, he was really like a sponge, I think, listening to the various economic theories that would be debated back and forth across the table. And I know he did that in other policy council meetings too. So he was. In fact, we did a little assessment of the policy councils and the attendance, because we were looking to see, is our cabinet members coming to these meetings, or are they sending their deputies, or who's coming? Bush was about number four in terms of having the best attendance record at policy council meetings after about the first 2 years or so. And I think that they did keep up. We didn't measure it there after the third year. But he was an active vice president.
You'll be meeting with the second group. You're the Iron Man today, because there'll be opportunity with a small group of scholars. But I wonder if, before we adjourn this part of the meeting, whether there are questions that some of you would like to ask that touch on maybe what will be discussed later in the day or what has already been discussed that you'd like to explore.
I have one other one, which is somewhat academic, but I think very important. What, in your mind, is the chief difference between management and leadership? I think you get that mixed up an awful lot. I notice you switch from one to the other.
Right.
And I think there's a distinct difference.
Right, absolutely. No, I agree with that. The leadership, to me, is that linkage between the person doing the leading and those doing the following, or those demanding leadership of the leader. I shouldn't say following. That connotes some subjugation. To me, in our country, we can demand leadership from our, quote, elected leaders. And the leader in that context is the one who is the most sensitive to those demands for leadership. Now, by sensitive to, though, I don't mean always responsive to. I mean, my view of a president, a presidential leader especially, is a person who can balance sort of two things. One, these demands that people make for him, make up to him or on him for leadership, balancing off his responsiveness to those demands with his own vision of where the organization ought to go, where the country in this case ought to go. That is, he's got his strong view, and from time to time that may be in opposition to what maybe the majority is demanding. But he will, the good leader in my view, will balance those off, will not be too far, too responsive, because if he is, he's seen as a weak leader. He's saying, well, he's dancing to somebody else's tune. If he's too far the other direction, he's just pushing his own agenda, his own way of doing things without any attention to these demands being made, then he's out of touch, as they say. So to me, the strong leader and leadership is the essence of striking that balance between the actions you take.
Can I use a word
sure.
and then see whether you agree with
Please
it?
Please do.
My very simple definition of leadership is the ability to inspire others willingly to do what you want them to do and to follow you. In other words, you have to be sensitive to what you want, but a leader is the guy that sets it and has the ability to get other people to do what he wants them to do. Now,
that's more so in
other fields than it is in government.
Right.
I think the essence of that is the essence of leadership. You've got to be strong enough, smart enough, experienced enough, skillful enough, whatever, to get other people to see it your mm-hmm. way and willingly. That's mm-hmm. the important thing. Willingly to follow you.
Yeah, I guess I would say that in many organizations that's as far as it goes. But for presidential leadership, it goes about the other half too, where you are not able to get people to do what you want them to do, but you understand enough of what they want to be done that you can balance those off and make sure their needs are being met and your own vision is at the same time being carried out too. So that's the way I'd make that. Let me just say one other thing I wanted to cover about as you reflect on it. Look at the way he handled Gorbachev too, which we'll say some more about his personality and his approach to, as I say, staying with in a confronting mode until the time is to get. Notice he didn't talk to him the first 4 years. And notice, Gorbachev wasn't in there. They had some of the others in there, but he was in there for a period of time. But notice that he still held out his evil empire idea until he had some, and his containment concept, until he began to believe that we were strong enough. He felt he built us back strong enough, and he felt he could see that there were enough there was enough opposition in different places around the world where communism may have been expanding that they would not expand much anymore. Though the Grenada thing was just one little incident in there, but notice he waited until a point in time when he says, "Okay, now's the time," and then he went over and saw Gorbachev, and then thereafter it was almost once a year. He was talking to him and taking a step at a time, and he probably got much further in terms of negotiating with the Soviets than anyone ever thought he would have, even all the way up to year four. I don't think anyone would have seen how or suspected how fast he would move in years 5, 6, and 7, and 8, despite the fact of the Iran-Contra that took a lot of his time away from that too. And all. But that's just another indication of what I mean about how he will hold his position for a long time until he feels he's done what he has to do to be bargaining from a strength position. And so that's one of his leadership styles too.
Well, I know some of you will want to read what Ralph Bledsoe says to the little group of scholars who will be meeting with him after this session, and we will be publishing that so that there is a side that you may want to tap later. One thing that comes out, I think, in this analysis so interestingly is that Ralph Bledsoe is both a theorist and a practitioner, and he was when he lived in Charlottesville. He served on several commissions. He was involved with an evaluation project of middle schools in Albemarle County.
That was the toughest group I've ever had to deal with. I can handle cabinet members on the policy council.
So we're very pleased and feel very, very fortunate that he's been willing to come on a warm day like this and talk with us about this question. Thank you.
Appreciate it.